At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk. Crazy weather we're having. No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
The Lifestyle Show, presented by Selena McKenzie.
Now, when Claire Wills was in her 20s, she discovered she had a cousin she'd never met. So she went on a quest to find out more, and she's here to tell us what she found. Welcome to the show, Claire.
Very pleased to be here.
So tell us the story then. You just discovered, how did you discover you had this cousin, and what made you want to find out more?
Well, I was in my mid-20s. I was a student, and I had a baby on my own. And shortly after that, I think because I was bringing up a baby on my own, my aunt, who was living in the west of Ireland, and where I used to spend a lot of time and had always spent a lot of time since I was small. My mother is from a small farm in the west of Ireland near Skibbereen. My aunt told me that in the 1950s, my uncle had got a neighbour pregnant, and the neighbour and my first cousin, who is 7 years older than me, had gone to a mother and baby home in Cork City. And subsequently, my cousin had been brought up in an orphanage, not far from the village and the farm I knew very well when I was growing up. None of my cousins or my siblings knew about her until, the late 1980s, 1990s. And, it was a tremendous shock to discover this. And I kind of spent a lot of time in the 90s trying to figure out what it meant, why would she have been kept secret? Mm. What were mother and baby homes? What were these orphanages? But it wasn't until, more like 10 years ago, when the scandal over mother and baby homes in Ireland kind of hit the national and international news after the discovery of kind of the remains of 800 babies and small children buried in the grounds of one of the homes in Galway. It wasn't until that moment that I really understood that the thing that I thought of as a kind of family secret, a private kind of shame, nobody had wanted to talk about it, was really a national story. Mm. And it was then that I came back to what I'd heard in the 1990s and tried to figure it out more, really.
Okay. So that was in the 50s. So she was in this mother and baby home. Was she just abandoned then as a single mother, or did she leave and leave the baby? How did it play out?
In the mother and baby homes, your listeners may have seen, the film Philomena.
Yes.
And you would stay there if you were a kind of supported by social services, by the county payment scheme. You couldn't leave your baby, and many of the mothers didn't want to leave their babies, of course. You had to stay there working for the home for 2, sometimes 3 years. And in my cousin's case, I think her mother stayed for 4 years in the mother and baby home in Cork with her before she moved to what's called an industrial school. Really, it's kind of orphanage, and they were called industrial schools because in the mid 19th century, when they were set up, it was where children were supposed to learn industry. you know, like, for girls, that would mostly be domestic service. And for boys, it might be farm work or whatever. Mm. So she'd moved then when she was about four to this industrial school in Clonakilty, where she had grown up. And her mother, I discovered this while I was writing the book, actually. Her mother had gone to America and wrote to her, but didn't really have contact with her following that time.
So she was brought up by this industrial-type orphanage?
Yeah, and those orphanages, like the mother and baby homes, were run by nuns. So the whole, you know, much of the social services in Ireland from the kind of 1920s when Ireland became independent, it's a very poor country, schools, hospitals, and kind of child protection services and all of that were run by the nuns.
Okay.
Because, you know, which was cheap because nuns didn't get paid. So there's a kind of Catholic social services system that people got channeled into, really.
Okay. So was it as simple as that, Claire? You found her and that was where she was brought up and that was it? Or did she move around?
It wasn't simple in that by the time I found out about her, she had died. My cousin
died. I'm so sorry. I didn't realise.
In 1980. She had, in fact, killed herself when she discovered that she herself had was pregnant. She was living in London at that time. And the book is really about the different ways in which unmarried pregnancy was handled and has been handled over about 100 years in Britain and Ireland. You know, as I told you at the beginning, I'd become pregnant when I was a student. And that was 1989. And I chose to keep my baby. He's now 35 and he's just had a baby of his own, in fact. And it was tricky, but it wasn't impossible. And I became very interested and appalled, really. Let's be honest, appalled by the difficulties that women in my situation had to face in, for example, the 1950s when my cousin was born. Or I discovered while I was writing the book that my grandmother, too, had been pregnant outside marriage in 1920. And I think that she was the product of an extramarital pregnancy in 1891, although I can't be sure of that. And one of the things I trace through in my book, Missing Persons, it's about the people who go missing from our families. One of the things I trace through is the different kinds of ways in which society responded and the different systems that they had for managing, either supporting or rejecting and piling shame on unmarried mothers.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I was lucky. I got to fall pregnant in the 1980s when the system was different, but not necessarily for everyone. And my cousin Mary had clearly felt the impossibility of going through the same system that she had been brought up in. She did not want to do that for her child.
Very sad. I remember when it all came out, a shocking scandal about the mother and baby homes in Ireland. So I can only sort of imagine what it was like. But thinking about your grandmother back in the 20s, that must have been even harder.
Well, you know, it was and it wasn't. So she became pregnant in Christmas 1920, which was in the middle of the Anglo-Irish War, the war between Britain and Ireland for independence. You know, the social structures were completely non-existent at this point. There were kind of soldiers on the roads. Very, very difficult to find any kind of support. She married before the baby was born. I do not know whether she married the father of the child. She was 6 months pregnant when she got married. And In a way, that was sort of typical for that period of 1890s, 1910s. She was right at the end of that moment where kind of informal ways of managing an unmarried pregnancy were common in, well, both rural and urban areas. So, you know, a child might be brought up by an aunt or informally adopted by a neighbour, or you'd get married just a bit late, and maybe not necessarily to the father of the child. Mm. But by the time the 1930s came along in Ireland, and we've got this kind of new Catholic sort of religious sort of movement for purity, and, you know, the Irish Catholics are going to be better than anyone else. They've got sort of institutional systems for dealing with this, the mother and baby homes and the orphanages and other kind of institutional structures. And actually, one of the things that I write about is how that made the situation for women far worse in the 1940s, 50s and 60s, and even right up into the 70s and 80s in Ireland, because you couldn't really manage things informally anymore. It meant that family bonds were completely broken rather than hidden or managed in another way. So since the book was published, it was published, the paperback is coming out next week, but it was published a year ago in hardback, and many, many people who were born in mother and baby homes or brought up in orphanages, or family members who have who know that they have got siblings that they've never met, you know, that system meant that the sort of families were bureaucratized rather than able to manage things themselves. And I think it was far worse in the 1950s, in fact, than in the 1920s.
And did your aunt keep in... No, it wasn't your aunt, was it? It was your uncle, yeah. and a neighbour. I'm just trying to think. The one person that a girl needs when she's pregnant with her first child is a mother. And I just wondered if... Was it Mary, your cousin, had anyone that she could turn to?
I fear that she did not. I think that's again, this problem of the division of people. Part of what the book is about is the kind of obsession with people who belong rightfully to a family, who are legitimate, and they get, you know, they get looked after. And if you're born on the wrong side of the blanket, as it were, you're classed as illegitimate or just you don't belong. You don't get that support. You don't get that help. You can never truly belong. My book is a kind of plea for us to rethink the way we imagine what a family is. And it's not just, you know, the two parents and the nuclear family, the children descended from those two parents. It's all the kind of people who've been cut out and put into sort of into institutions or kind of got rid of because they don't fit the right template. What would our families really look like if we included all the people who don't properly belong, mm-hmm. or are not properly belonging? And I think it would be a much better form of family.
Well, yes, it sounds it, doesn't it? It's blood when all's said and done. Family is family, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And did you ever see pictures or photographs of Mary? I mean, do you feel like you know her?
I do have a picture of Mary, a couple of pictures. Weirdly, she looks very, very like my oldest sister. I don't feel I got to know her. And one of the things that I write about in the book is that I also felt I didn't have the right to try to get to know her. Mm. When I first found out about her, I was so shocked and appalled that for me it was important. I was trained as a historian and someone who interprets documents and archives. I felt it was really important that I recover my cousin Mary and her mother Lily from their kind of being hidden in archives and institutions. But as I wrote the book, I thought, actually, I don't have the right to do that. I never knew them. They didn't want me to know them. They were on the other side of the family. But what I did have access to, the story that was my story, was a story about the people who rejected her.
Mm.
So really, in my book, I wanted to call it Making Sense of the Missing. The publisher didn't like it, so it's Missing Persons. But, you know, how did my grandmother make sense of the fact that she rejected her granddaughter? Why did it make sense to her? So that's really what the book is about, trying to understand why that system made sense to people. You know, this is my grandmother who had herself been pregnant outside marriage in the 1920s. So she knew exactly what it was like to, you know, fall on the wrong side of respectability. Yet she still rejected her.
Yeah.
So for me, it was important that I didn't try and write the story that didn't belong to me. And I felt that Mary, what I knew about Mary was that my family had rejected her. And that's what I wanted to try and understand.
Did you ever ask your grandmother, Claire, or was it too late by then?
It was too late. She also died in 1980. Oh. I did ask my mother and my aunts, and I made a real pain of myself asking everybody I could think of. And, you know, it's difficult to write, you know, if the question you're asking is, why did people in a family behave in this way? You've got no documents. There's nothing going to tell you, you know, I mean, my family weren't writers of letters, let's put it like that. I've got no written document telling me, well, we did this because we were worried about farm inheritance or something. I've got nothing like that. Mm. So I had to interpret the stories that I could get out of my mother and my aunt about what went on, not only in the 1950s, but how the family thought of things like respectability and Catholicism and their faith. And so it's a book in which I try and interpret family anecdotes as much as anything, because, you know, we're all part of the family archive. And the family archive is mainly not in libraries. It's in the people who we talk to.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting story, and I think it's an important one as well for people to understand. The title is Missing Persons or My Grandmother's Secrets by Claire Wills, who we're chatting to now. Claire, as you mentioned, you are a historian, and I know you've written other books. So how can people find out a little more about you?
Oh, well, I teach at Cambridge. I've got a web page at Cambridge. The best way to find out about me is to read Missing Persons, because it's also a kind of autobiography. And I do talk about the decision I made in the 1980s to keep my own baby, which, you know, wasn't the norm necessarily what most of my colleagues who were also being academics were doing. But, you know, I hope they enjoy reading it.
Oh, well, I wish you lots of luck with the book. Thank you for joining us, Claire Wills.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.